Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Have you ever read the newspaper The Onion? I remember I was so impressed because I was introduced to it. I started reading it online like in the 90s. And then I saw that they were an actual paper. I thought, oh, that's a pretty cool idea that a website became a newspaper. I didn't know they were a newspaper before that. So talk to the founder or co-founder or co-founding editor, Scott Dickers, all about humor, comedy, writing comedy, building up The Onion. How did The Onion succeed? It's an incredible story. Here it is.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
Scott, how would you take something as boring as microphones and make it an Onion headline?
Well, that's the beauty of The Onion and The Onion headline is that you can make it about anything.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, people always think that a restrictive format, like a news parody format, is going to restrict your creativity. It actually expands it greatly because it allows a channel for it to go. A creative person can just get unmoored if there's no kind of structure for the joke. So, you know, if I had to like brainstorm 10 Onion headlines about microphones, I could do it if you gave me a few minutes, but I'm probably not going to be able to do it off the top of my head.
I keep thinking of your recent headline, police chief yells at Herschel Walker for blowing cover in undercover Senate-run operation. That's great. So maybe like Herschel Walker thought microphone was, you know, secret listening device for the, I don't know. Now I'm not coming up with any ideas, but.
Well, you see how difficult it is. If everybody could do it, everybody would own The Onion.
And
it
yeah. So you've been doing this for like, what is it now? I mean, The Onion started around 1988 and you were the co-founding editor.
Yeah. And I was editor in chief on and off for many years. I have finally left for the final time. I come and go, but I have left for the final time now.
Why is that? Why'd you leave for the final time? I mean, it's a long time to do something, so I respect that, but.
Yeah. You know, every time I've left, it was because I felt like, okay, I've done what I can do here. And I want to do other things. And then for whatever reason, they would ask me back or they would get into new things that would, you know, excite me because they were challenging. And so I would come back. But now I feel like ownership has changed so many times and the people who are running it really want their turn, you know, so I don't see them ever asking me back. But if they did, like, it's my baby, so I would totally help. But
was it ever like a big business?
Yeah, it keeps getting bigger, you know? It's a lot of employees. There's like a board. I remember one time I was the editor. I was in charge of all the creative and kind of focused on that. And I saw a bunch of these guys in tucked in polo shirts and blazers come into the office. And I asked our financial guy, like the CFO, I was like, who are these guys? And he said, oh, that's our board of directors. And I said, We have a board of directors? There's no creative person on the board of directors. It's all these suits. Like, who knows where they came from? They're advising the Onion's leadership team about what to do. And the writers and the editors are just siloed into this other office where we're just coming up with jokes. Not how it always used to be, but that gives you some idea. It's turned into like a big company.
And by big company, like, are you talking $100 million in revenues or, you know, like how big
yeah,
is
as
it?
As far as revenues, I'm sure it's in the tens of millions mm-hmm. Per year in revenue. And every time it sells, you know, it sells for tens of millions. But, you know, the value of a publication is in the goodwill and the name. So, you know, it's almost hard to quantify that.
And The Onion has withstood the test of time. I mean, I first saw The Onion, I guess, back in the late 90s on the web. But then I was so surprised to see also there were print versions, you know, in every grocery store or pharmacy or whatever. And I'm like, oh, there are a print version too. But you started out as a print version in the 80s.
Yeah, a lot of people don't even realize that it started in print and was in print for like 7 years before we went online. And kind of the whole history of The Onion, like behind the curtain that people don't see, like the business side of it, was really, you know, lucky, because there were so many times when The Onion could have taken a deadly hit and it survived. And one of the first times was when the internet market crashed in 2000, 2001. It was like early 2001. And so many other websites, and The Onion was among them, like these big websites that everybody knew, and some of them had millions of dollars of investment, celebrity endorsements. And I went out to some of these places before the crash, and there were airport hangar-sized offices with people in cubicles doing stuff. And after the crash, those things were gone. They just vanished in a heartbeat. But The Onion was primarily making its money from the print publications. It was like maybe 80% still making money from print advertising. So when that all folded, The Onion survived just fine. And then when the market crashed again in 2008, when the print market crashed, by then The Onion was like 80% digital, 20% print. But, you know, we always diversified, and it wasn't any kind of smart business strategy that had us diversifying. All it was my total obsession and ambition to get The Onion anywhere and everywhere we could get it. So as soon as the internet became a thing, we were like, get it online. As soon as podcasting became a thing, get it on a podcast. You know, we were on the radio, I think in year two, we did a little radio show. So we had all this diversification. We had all these little revenue streams, so we could take a hit in one or the other and survive. And I actually learned a lot from other humor publications that came before The Onion about what not to do, because humor publications in America don't survive very long. The Onion is the longest surviving one by far.
What about, I mean, I don't even know. I mean, all through my childhood, I read Mad Magazine, but I actually have no idea if it's still around.
Well, they went out of business recently. I think, you know, the name still survives, and I don't know what's happening with it, but they stopped publishing. You know, they went down to, I remember if it was bi-monthly or something like that. And they were purchased by some big company, some comic book company. But yeah, so I think technically, if you consider Mad Magazine still alive, and you know, the National Lampoon name is still alive too, and people are always trying to resuscitate that. But when I say longest surviving, I mean longest surviving and thriving, like still relevant.
Well, I would say
Cracked is doing great.
Yeah, Cracked.com is great. I've actually written for Cracked.com, and
I think that's great.
Yeah. And they have a very specific formula, and I'm going to ask you about that as well. Like their whole thing is the article has to be true, but ridiculous. So you have to kind of find really true facts, but to basically underline the ridiculousness of some aspect of life. Like you can't make up stuff, and it has to be funny though.
Yeah. When I was a kid, Mad was the undisputed leader in the Mad Cracked war.
Yeah.
But once the internet came, Cracked really laid waste to Mad Magazine. Cracked was really killing it. And you couldn't even find mad.com. If you Googled mad.com, it was just like, it disappeared. And yeah, they really embraced that news of the weird idea that the National Lampoon got started. Totally different from what they used to do, which was pretty much the same thing as Mad Magazine. They would do parodies and, you know, comics and stuff like that. So they've been smart.
You made a really good point distinguishing the National Lampoon and The Onion in your book about the history of The Onion, where you said National Lampoon kind of started to revolve around the names and personalities of the writers. So when one writer left, you would just sort of know, and it would you know, the quality would go, just like with SNL now, if right. an actor leaves, a famous actor leaves, people say, oh, it's no good since that's the so-and-so left. And with The Onion, you deliberately kept names off the bylines.
Yeah, which was, it's something people always ask about, especially other comedy writers and people in the business. Like, how can you do that? How don't writers want credit? And it's never been a problem. From day one, we knew that it was funnier if there were no names, because then it seemed more like this instrument of truth handed down from on high that you just had to believe. And it felt more impenetrable without the names. And it was fun to have people guessing, who's behind this? What is this? And we had a staff box. I guess that's kind of a standard thing. A newspaper or a website has to have like a masthead. But we would shuffle the names around and change the titles so nobody would really know who was what. And nobody ever complained. Nobody ever had a problem with that. It became a real integral part of the culture because everyone understood that we were building a brand that we wanted people to love. We weren't building personal careers or personalities that we wanted people to fall in love with, because that can only end in disaster for a humor publication.
Well, and I think the brand became so powerful that if you wrote for The Onion and later were able to say, hey, I wrote for The Onion, people don't know what articles you wrote. It's like you wrote everything. So your personal brand actually was elevated later if you wrote for The Onion.
Yeah, and I can't tell you how many like Hollywood agents I meet who tell me, oh yeah, I've got a client who used to work for The Onion. And I'm like, who? And they give me the name and I have no idea who it is, because they wrote one headline in 1996 or something. But, you know, it really has become a good calling card. There's so many people who have worked at The Onion and have been incredibly successful. Like one guy wasn't even part of the core group, but he did write headlines for us for a long time. He was a regular contributor, a guy by the name of Sam Means, who went on to be an instrumental creative force at The Office and at Parks and Rec. Mm. And, you know, there have been so many others, but that's amazing, because when we started, there was this thing called the Harvard Lampoon Mafia, where people would go to the Harvard Lampoon and kind of get a direct channel to, I don't know, The Simpsons or any kind of sitcom right. they wanted to write on. And it seems like The Onion is that now.
First off, I want to ask you about media in general. Like right now, and maybe people always say this about media, but right now it seems media is more ridiculous than ever. Like you almost read an article in any newspaper and you think, did I just read? It's almost a cliche to say, is this The Onion or is this the New York Times? Like, because a lot of these headlines sound ridiculous. Like, do you find that the ridiculousness of traditional media now almost is a danger to The Onion?
A little bit, yeah, and I think they were influenced by The Onion. I think they saw that in this period when print was dying, The Onion was growing. And so they I think, did some self-assessment and realized, oh, if we're a little more absurd, if we have a little more grabby headline, you know, because I know just from working at The Onion that watching the most emailed story or the most clicked on story, you're looking at the heat map analysis of the week. I know other newspapers were doing the same thing. So they know what works and what doesn't work. And some long, boring article about a really important voting rights bill in Congress is not going to get nearly as many hits as some news of the weird story, you know, about a 21-year-old hottie or, you know, sex scandal, you name it. So I do see that change. And obviously part of it is the repeal of the fairness doctrine and how you can integrate opinion with news now in a way that you really couldn't, like before the 1980s.
Oh, well, why is that? I don't know the fairness doctrine. Like what? I just thought this was a natural evolution.
Yeah, it was an FCC rule that Reagan's FCC director decided we don't need anymore. And it basically meant that if you devoted time to a political opinion on the air, you had to devote equal time to an opposing opinion. Before that time, it was almost like a culture that existed within news, where a lot of networks provided news as a public service to create an informed citizenry. All that is out the window now. So all the news networks are for profit and they don't have to have balance. So that's what allowed for the rise of Fox News. And that's how, you know, big advertisers can basically own the narrative on all the news channels, regardless of which ones we're talking about. The big pharma companies, the big oil companies, they're the major advertisers on all these networks. So that's why we get fluff. You know, we don't get any real news about what's really happening because they're kind of untethered. The whole thing is just, it's unraveled to a point that I don't see it ever becoming raveled again. It's sad and depressing, and I hope that it wasn't my fault.
Well, I don't think it was your fault. Like you said, I think the profit motive is strong with the media companies, and they legit, I mean, they're technically, they're all out of business, right? So the New York Times was bought by, I guess, Carlos Slim, the richest guy in Mexico, because they couldn't afford to live themselves. The Washington Post was bought by Jeff Bezos. You know, Wall Street Journal is just a toy for Rupert Murdoch. None of these news, none of the greatest newspapers in U.S. history could survive on their own now, other than The Onion.
Yeah. You know, and even The Onion was bought, but I think it actually does, you know, make a profit. And it goes to show you, like, the value of the goodwill of those names. You know, The New York Times has a brand and a goodwill that is, it could survive decades of ownership by the most unscrupulous people imaginable, and people would still read it and believe it. And The Washington Post, you know, is happening now, you know. Who would believe the Jeff Bezos newsletter? Like, who would buy that and believe it? But that's what the Washington Post is. And people get so tied up in the power of the brand. You know, we're lemmings. We just follow the brand. We follow the logo. And we don't really think beyond that. We all have busy lives. We have families. You know, we don't have time to, like, dig deeper and do research. So if we see the Washington Post, we see a story, we just automatically trust it. And that's super frightening. And I don't see how or where it ends. I have a lot of faith in the internet. I have a lot of faith in alternative news sources. But my God, that's just as much of a mess, because everybody's in their own silo of truth. And now we have, like, competing facts. It's just terrifying.
Well, it's really true. Like, have you ever had an article written in one of these major publications about you or The Onion? I'm sure there's been many.
Oh, yeah, all the time.
And let me ask you a question. In each one of those articles, would you say they were 100% true or...
No, never. I'm sure you've had the same experience. You read these articles and you're like, where did they get that?
You right.
Know, they and have so a that, narrative.
And that's where you see the article and you know what's true. So exactly. Imagine all the articles you don't know. You have to assume they're not true either.
It's happening in every single article. So a lot of people think that, oh, that couldn't be true. That couldn't be happening. It's how could anyone be that devious? But it's not devious at all. It's just a matter of the culture. Like, what news anchor, what news reporter is going to get hired in an organization that Jeff Bezos owns, who is going to speak ill of Jeff Bezos? It's not going to happen. So you're just automatically, you're building kind of bribery and coercion into the system, so it doesn't feel like it. It just feels like people are doing their jobs. And everyone has this establishment bias, or this bias toward the richest 1% in America. And they think it's normal. And everybody who reads it just thinks that's normal. And we're really hoodwinked by it. Like, the vast majority of the American public are totally in the pocket. Propaganda works. You know, it really is powerful.
Yeah, and you figure it's not just the owners of... It's not just Jeff Bezos, but it's also all the advertisers of the Washington Post.
Of course.
If Chase Bank is the big advertiser, or if, like, Exxon is the biggest advertiser in the Washington Post, there's probably not going to be too many bad articles about, you know, polluting in the ocean or whatever it is.
Nope. acidification of the oceans, climate change, that's all kind of off limits. Or you can do some article about it to make it look like you care by saying, well, by 2100, scientists think the ocean level, sea level might rise by 1 inch, you know, or something like that. But I remember when The Onion started, we had a deal, and this deal is gone now. But so I had a business partner who handled all the business, and I handled all the editorial. And our deal was he couldn't tell me what to print, and I couldn't tell him how to spend the money. So we would sometimes do an article that would just tear apart one of our major advertisers. we were struggling for so many years in the beginning to get good advertisers, to get national advertisers. We finally got one. We got like a major cigarette advertiser, I believe, to do a color ad on the back page. Big deal for us. And we did a big front page story about how the dangers of secondhand smoke. Like, I think the headline was, secondhand smoke causes secondhand coolness. And so, you know, we're just tearing apart all their PR that they're trying to put out there about how cigarettes are cool and smoking is cool and don't worry about secondhand smoke and all that stuff. And we lost advertisers because of that. And that could never fly in any other media organization. And it actually worked at The Onion. Like, we lost advertisers, but we gained an audience because the audience saw that we were fearless. And we also gained new advertisers who knew that they would be made fun of, but wanted to be a part of that because they knew they were getting the eyeballs, you know? And so it's a system that can work, but I don't see the major media ever adopting anything like that.
I see how it could work because let's just take the case of the cigarette companies. They could lean into this
totally.
in a way, like, and say, hey, people are going to smoke anyway. Everybody in the country already knows cigarette smoking is bad for you, and yet tens of millions of people smoke. So it's not like your parody article is going to suddenly wake people up and say, you know, it really doesn't make me secondhand cool. I'm going to stop smoking. So they could lean into it and just like enjoy the party. Like, you know, it is what it is. But I want to take apart that one headline because this gets into process. Where, what's the process for coming up with a headline like that? Is it kind of, and I know you're a big fan of quantity produces quality, which I think is a very important part of creativity. Is it just that you throw it out to, you know, tons of people and to come up with as many ideas as possible and then you pick the best one? Or is there kind of a little bit of a formula of, hey, what can we say about this that hasn't been said before?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. So you always do the kind of open invitation to the writing staff, write whatever you want, and then we'll read through all those headlines and pick like 0.01% of them that are funny and we'll run those. And that's how you kind of tap into the zeitgeist and you come up with interesting ideas you might not have ever come up with because it's just you're saying, hey, what's on your mind, you know? But then occasionally something big will happen in the news or there's some issue that you feel like you want to cover. And then you tell people, hey, let's come up with a few headlines on this subject, you know, and then the process is the same. They come up with a ton. We read through them and try to find the best one. And I remember when we were doing our first original book, it was a look back at the history of the 20th century through fake front pages of The Onion. And we wanted to cover every major news event in the 20th century as if The Onion had been there to cover it. And we really wanted to like nail every single event with the best joke we could find. And that was really hard. I remember there were some that we went back and back and round after round to come up with a joke. And it was like, oh, still don't have it. Still not there, you know? So it can be really hard. It can be really monotonous. Like the process is not fun or funny. There's rarely any laughs. It's very intellectual. You know, it's a lot of like, you know, at The Onion, we always hired like genius level people, like just super high IQ people. Like every single one of them was like twice as smart as I was. And you sit in this room and you hear these people have these intellectual conversations about why this word was funnier than this word and why this particular structure of a joke is better than this particular structure. And nobody's like cracking up. It's not like a a party. It's not like, you know, the Dick Van Dyke Show or 30 Rock or something. It's, you know, it would be dispiriting for just about anybody who had any fantasy of what being in a writer's room would be like.
I'm just curious, like, do you remember any of the details of any of these arguments? Like, what did someone say was a word that was funnier than another, or a structure that was funnier than another structure?
Oh man, there's so many. We used to have a sign on the wall that was like, words you can't use anymore. And some of them were pretty funny, but like they'd been used once or twice too much, like in the culture. So they don't work anymore. You know, God help me, I'm not gonna be able to think of any examples off the top of my head. But as far as structure goes, it was always a matter of like shifting words around and trying to put the funny part last. Sometimes,
yeah, like that secondhand smoke doesn't lead to secondhand coolness. Like that's very interesting because there's so many medical studies on the effects of secondhand smoke, but right. you mix that with the concept that teenagers smoke because it looks cool or they think it looks right. cool. So combining those two concepts creates a really funny headline. And like you say, the joke comes last, like the word coolness is the last word.
Yep, the you weird or unusual or funny word. And then you have that repetition, the alliteration with the repetition of the word secondhand, which is a bit of wordplay that always works.
And also secondhand coolness is not necessarily, that's a phrase that's never used, but you know what it means. Like, exactly. You know, it's just, without it meaning anything, you sort of have a sense right. of what it means. So that exactly. That weird use of the phrase is funny.
Yeah. So there's a lot of examples like that where, and also just cutting words. Like sometimes a headline comes in, it's pretty funny, but just has too many words, you know? So you could say secondhand smoke leads to secondhand coolness, but it's funnier as causes because it's one word and instead of two, and it just makes the whole thing shorter, and brevity is the soul of wit, you know? So a lot of times it's almost like a math puzzle, almost like, you know, these computer scientists sit in rooms to figure out how to cram more gigabytes into a smaller hard drive. And we get these, you know, increasing capacity in hard drives. That's how it often felt in the Onion writer's room with each joke, like whittling it down to its bare essence, you know, and you cut one word and it's like, now it's not funny anymore. So we've cut too much. We've gone too far. So we got to put that back.
And leads to, it's funny because, so I used to do stand-up comedy for many years and I don't know if it's the same with the written word versus when you say words out loud, but like leads to, in a very small way, is not as funny as causes because the K sound is considered a funnier sound.
There's that too. Yeah. So you always have to consider the sound of the words, the poetry of the words. It is very similar in stand-up. You know, you want to be as concise as possible as well. You don't want to be up there blathering, filling time. So,
and you know, like you've mentioned in your book about the history of the Onion, there's been nonstop competition since day one. And like now I would say almost equivalent in humor to the Onion is the Babylon Bee. And they're building a strong brand very quickly.
They're doing great. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, do you see them as, obviously they're competition, but do you see them as a threat or?
No, I don't see any of it as a threat. I feel like comedy is not a zero-sum game. I think there can be as much as you want. And as long as it's finding an audience, it's going to be fine. And if anything, I think it helps. You know, each thing helps the other. You know, the Onion has obviously helped the Babylon Bee. I think they help us.
I would say the Babylon Bee is almost like they've really taken the Onion formula, and I don't want to say copied it, but they're very similar in style, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, the Onion has always tried to be an equal opportunity offender, always tried to be non-political, but let's be honest, most comedy writers are progressives, and so you definitely have a progressive bent. But being progressive, in my opinion, is sort of like favoring the 99% over the 1%. So that's why most comedy is progressive, because it really targets the vast majority of the audience. However they just, you know, think of themselves politically, almost everybody agrees with progressive policies. you know, they're pro people, they're anti, you know, pollution, basic stuff like that. But when it comes down to semantics, and, you know, some people consider themselves conservative, some people consider themselves liberal, that's where the Babylon Bee does well, because the conservative people think, well, there's no comedy for me. You know, all the comedy is liberal. Again, thinking of it in a very narrow way. And so they did a great job of carving out that niche so that conservative people can have an onion that they like, you know?
The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX is track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura's been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long, and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast, and the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. So let's say there was a news topic that's important, that's topical, It seems like your process was more, hey, let's hire the funniest people possible, tell them the topic, tell them to focus on quantity and you'll figure something out. Or was there a little bit of guidance and, hey, here's how you write an Onion article? Just like with Cracked, it's very much not, I don't want to say a formula, you still have to be funny, but it's a lot more of a formula based.
Yeah, there is a little bit more of a formula now at The Onion, and I've seen how they communicate with potential contributors. They have very strict structures and rules, and I also see it in the articles, and that kind of bothers me a little bit because I liked when it was more open. I liked when it was, you know, you couldn't really predict what would happen. You couldn't always predict. Like now in the news and brief stories, there's always an actuality in the second sentence. There's always a joke in the last sentence that starts at press time. And that starts to feel like a formula and a cliche and like a mold. And yeah, I certainly wouldn't be doing that. I don't like it. And when I was running The Onion, yes, I would train people. And I would always hire people who had no comedy experience. So they weren't hacks and they had no comedy, you know, bad habits. And I would basically...
But you would hire some people though from like the improv world. And it seems like you did hire people who had some.
Yeah, but no professional experience.
Okay.
Like always amateur comedy experience. And I would teach them the fundamentals of like, you know, joke concept structure and the 11 funny filters that I describe in my book, How to Write Funny, and I teach in my classes. And then from there, you funnel that into the news parody format, and the world is your oyster. I would never teach people or train people to do something in a mold, you know, that it always has to be like this and always has to be structured like this, because that's not how the real news is. And if you're parodying the real news, you want to be a little more open about it and have these kind of basic ideas of, well, you want your nut graph at the top and you want to make sure you're not editorializing, you know, all these other AP style things.
What's a nut graph?
Oh, that's the first paragraph in a news story that has the who, what, where, why.
And so, okay. So I'm sorry, I haven't read your How to Write Funny books, but I am going to buy them. They look great.
You.
I was just looking at them. I have read your story about the history of the Onion. So what are like some of the, you know, one or two of the 11 funny filters?
Yeah. So these are tools that professional comedians use to make things funny. And we used to talk about these things in the Onion meetings all the time. We kind of had a shorthand for them. And other comedians talk about them as well. George Carlin once said that he knows if a joke is going to work before he performs it on stage because it has all the elements. And another comedian he was talking to was like, oh, what are those elements? You know, and so there are 11 of them, and I call them the funny filters, and no one had ever really written them down or named them all. So I did it just in a really plain, matter of fact, you know, nonfiction short handbook, so that people could pick it up, learn it, and get a head start in their comedy, because a lot of people in comedy don't want to tell you the secret. They want you to pay your dues and trial and error and all this other nonsense. I think comedy should be more like magic, where you can buy magic trick books and they tell you exactly how to do it. So yeah, just to give you a couple of the 11, these are the 11 different ways that jokes can be funny. You take a concept, some idea or thought that you have, an observation about the world, and you turn it into something funny by filtering it through one of these 11 things. So a few of them are irony. That is, you just say the opposite of what your opinion is. Another one is misplaced focus, where you intentionally focus on the wrong thing to make the audience think of the thing that you're trying to say. And
what's an example of that? What's an example of that?
Well, a great example of that would be Anthony Jeselnik's stand-up comedy, if you know him.
Yeah, yeah.
Almost every one of his jokes is a misdirection. So he gets you focusing on one thing, and then he reveals at the end that you were focusing on the wrong thing. I'll give you an example from The Onion. So we did a headline about the band U2, and it was rest of U2 totally fine with Africans starving. So it was a joke about how Bono is always trying to raise money for starving Africans. but instead it focused on the other band members. Like, what are they doing? You know?
Right.
And it interviewed them and they were like, oh no, I'm mostly concerned with, you know, coming up with cool guitar riffs, you know, starving kids is not my thing, or not, that's Bono's thing. And we never mention Bono. We never mention what he does. You just focus on the other thing. And it's funny to focus on the smaller thing that doesn't often get focus. It makes people realize what you're saying, which is, in that article, I think the subtext is really interesting because it's saying Bono cares about starving Africans and no one else does. You, the reader, don't care because you're just like these guys. What are you doing for starving Africans? And it's always interesting satire when you can indict the reader in some way, make them laugh at their own failings, you know?
And so wait, which funny filter was that?
That's misplaced focus.
Because, okay, so can I tell you an Anthony Jeselnik joke that reminds
Please.
Me of? Okay, and yeah. I'll just, he has a particular style of telling a joke, so I won't emulate that style. But he basically says, you know, I pay 75 cents a day to feed a kid in Africa. 75 cents a day, I pay for his food. I pay for his shelter. I pay for his education. And that 75 cents is nothing compared to the cost of sending him to Africa.
Yeah, that's good.
By the way, I messed it up because he concluded, of course, with the funniest thing at the end. He doesn't say to Africa, he says to there or whatever.
Of shipping him to there or something. Him there. Yeah. That's what he does. So, and you know,
but it's like a magic trick with him. You always are trying to figure out halfway through what,
how's he going to twist this to be dark in the end? Yeah. And that's one way to do it. And a lot of stand-up comics are kind of aping that formula right now where they do that.
It's hard though, because if you do like a 60-minute special of that, that is incredibly hard to write, as opposed to like storytelling and having funny incidents in the story. Like, to write, like, he has to basically write like 50 one-liners like that. It's almost impossible.
And remembering it on stage is this mind-boggling how somebody can do that. Yeah, he's quite good, obviously.
Another funny filter?
Another one that we all know and love is hyperbole. And that's one of the toughest ones, when you just take the unfunny idea that you have and you exaggerate it to an absurd extreme. Sometimes people exaggerate a little bit and then you kind of have like a poor man's hyperbole. But if you exaggerate it to the point that is impossible or super, super absurd, violating the laws of physics, violating any law of science, then it's going to be funny. So, kind of the classic Borscht Belt comedians would always do that. They would do hyperbole. Johnny Carson would do that. This time-honored thing. We still do it today. It's just, it's in a different structure, so it feels more modern. But anytime you hear like a stand-up comic doing a bit, they're going to escalate it, and they're going to ultimately get to some hyperbolic point where whatever point they're making is so absurd that it's impossible, you know?
Yeah, no, it's true. And then, you know, there's one comedian, Andrew Schultz, who he has this interesting way of taking two concepts that are unrelated and by connecting them, making it funny. So
that's another one of the funny filters. That's analogy.
Yeah. So like he'll say, you know, you ever notice the countries with the best food treat their women the worst? Like, no one ever says, hey, let's go out and get some Canadian food tonight. You know, it's always like Middle Eastern food where they chop off their hands or whatever. Yeah. So,
yeah. And he's doing some amazing work. Like, he's a really impressive guy.
Yeah.
The way he harnesses a lot of the controversies that we're all thinking about and talking about and can make us, you know, kind of relax and laugh at them, that's really hard, you know? So he's doing some impressive work.
Yeah. No, I wonder if that's a progressive thing or a conservative thing, because right now the progressives take woke culture very seriously. So it's really hard to joke about it. Whereas, you know, and I would say Andrew Schultz leans more on the right of center side, and he's able to poke fun at wokeism a little bit.
Yeah. So you can poke fun at wokeism. You can poke fun at anything, but at the end of the day, you can't overtly violate it. Like, if Andrew Schultz got up on stage and said, yeah, I don't believe in a woman's right to choose, or I don't think gay people should get married, he'd be canceled, you know?
Right.
So he has to play to the audience's good intentions. Like, they They like people. They want people to be free and they want people to have rights. And I think within that parameter, and Bill Burr does this too, like he can pretend to sort of be the aggrieved white male who's tired of all these other people getting almost as many rights as him. And it works, you know, because he toes the line. He's really an expert at toying that line.
He's very close though, because it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell when he's ranting and then you get a little upset, or if he's telling a joke, because his punchlines are not as punchy. It's more his rant that is funny.
Yeah, like he did a bit on abortion in his recent special, and Bill Burr covered abortion in his recent special. And they both did the exact same thing. It was very fascinating to me how they did this. They play to the progressive base, because you always have to. Otherwise, nobody likes you. Nobody's laughing if you don't do that. So their kind of base is, I believe in a woman's right to control her own body. That's foundational, bare minimum. But, you know, and then Andrew Schultz makes a joke about, so that when we get to heaven and God says, hey, you've been killing all these babies, I can say, hey, it wasn't me. It was the women. You know, that's a good joke. And Bill Burr said, his joke on it was, you know, I believe in a woman's right to choose, of course. But on the other hand, you are killing a baby. You are definitely killing a baby, you know.
And Louis C.K. also has something in his, I think it's Louis C.K. 2017, where he says, you basically either believe you're killing a baby or you're taking a giant shit. And if you're taking a giant, and he goes on and on, but then he basically says, just know you're just killing babies and it's okay.
Right. Yeah. And that was Bill Burr's thing too, is like, you know what? I don't mind. Kill them.
Yeah.
So it's always very interesting to me to see how people handle that, because it's very important that they play to that 99% that I talked about. But they can do that. The most skillful comedy writers can do that in a way that reaches people who identify as conservatives and people who identify as liberals and not alienate any of them.
Well, what's just one more funny filter, because these are fascinating.
Yeah, so another funny filter that I love is parody. So it's a funny filter that you can use to filter an idea into a joke by just mimicking a format or a voice that we've all heard before. For example, The Onion is a parody of a news organization. And just that little facade makes whatever you're saying a little funnier. And so parody can be a format like that. It can also be used within a joke. So you can have an Onion headline that uses parody that's within the parody of The Onion, you know? And the funny filters are like that. They're like toys. You can do a funny filter within a funny filter. You combine funny filters to make new funny filters. So there's 11 of them, but there's almost an unlimited amount of or kinds of jokes that you can make with them.
Have you ever considered stand-up?
Oh, yeah. So I've been, I actually thought I was going to start it as a stand-up. You know, I did that for my high school talent show. But then I got into doing comic strips and doing The Onion. And so for like decades, I was behind the scenes and my performing muscle totally atrophied. But then I started going out representing The Onion, because they would want someone from The Onion to come to a college and do a show. And so I had to write like a kind of a one-man show. And then when I left The Onion, I kept doing that, but I wasn't representing The Onion anymore. I was just myself. And that became like, you know, my stand-up act, I guess. It was very Onion-focused. And only recently, like in the past, I don't know, 5 or so years, I've been doing more actual stand-up, where I go to open mics and I don't tell people I'm affiliated with The Onion in any way. So I kind of have a, you know, blank slate. And it's so fun and challenging and fascinating, because it's a totally different muscle than,
yeah,
as you know, from doing written comedy, because it's your personhood and your confidence and stage presence are such a huge part of the mix.
I mean,
it's not just about the jokes.
I remember watching a very, very early Jeselnik set, and he was a great writer from the beginning, because he wrote for, I forgot what show he wrote for, maybe Jimmy Kimmel. And so he was used to writing tons of jokes, and he got very good as a joke writer. And then the Jimmy Kimmel staff did a stand-up set. And so this was like a very early set from Jeselnik. And he he's great, but he didn't have the performance skill he has now. And right. just adding that performance skill is like a 10x factor on his, you know, that's why he's one of the greats now.
Yeah, you watch somebody like him on stage and you can't fake that kind of self-assuredness. You know, that is so powerful. And it takes time to develop that, you know? So it's fun to be on that journey and being in that process. I'm just loving it to death.
And he gets away with, I know we've been focusing on Jeselnik, there's lots of great comedians.
Sorry.
But he gets away with, like, it's very obvious he's performing material and we're okay with it. But some comedians, you're not, if you know it's material, it turns you off a little bit. They're going to tell this. You feel like they're being slutty. They're going to tell this to the same audience every day. But with Jeselnik, you're kind of okay because it's so much of a magic trick. You really just want to see how he pulls the rabbit out of the hat on each joke. Whereas with Dave Chappelle, or like Dave Chappelle's an example on the other side where you don't feel like this is material at all. And he's just having a conversation with the audience and he might have a different one tomorrow.
Yeah, and obviously almost no comedian is doing that. But it's really interesting how so many comedians now are sort of doing that style of revealing something personal about themselves.
Yeah.
And that's how they connect with the audience. And it is kind of an easy way to connect with the audience, but it's become such a cliche. It's almost like people think that's a rule now that you have to do that. And there are so many comedians like Jeselnik. And, you know, Steve Martin is another one, never revealed anything about himself on stage. It wasn't about him. You know, it was all silliness. And I like that broad range of possibilities in stand-up comedy to see what kind of new different things people are going to bring to it. It gets a little tiring seeing people always do the Chappelle, you know, Louis C.K., Bill Burr thing where it's just, hey, here's who I am and here's my opinion about life, you know.
Right, and Louis C.K. started off from a more classic standpoint. Like, he was an absurdist at first, and then over time, after he had kids, he's like, my kids suck, and then he got more personal.
Yeah, he's had a long evolution. You know, he started as a TV writer as well.
Yeah.
So I remember we were going to do an Onion TV special with him back in the late 90s, because we had worked on the Dana Carvey show together. It's been amazing to see his career, and then fascinating to see how he fell recently as well.
Yeah, and how he's dealing with that on stage, because now, I mean, he's selling out Madison Square Garden again, so he's able to then talk about these controversies on stage. But it's fascinating to watch. Like, you can't expect comedians to have perfect lives. Like, in many cases, they're comedians because they're almost grossly imperfect. And that's given them this, you know, weird perspective on life.
Yeah. I mean, I think it comes down to the audience, you know, like if the audience can accept you and laugh at you, great. If some people are going to be creeped out by you, by what you did, you know, like I can't listen to a Bill Cosby record the same way that I used to.
I know Bill Cosby was the first comedian I ever saw live. Like, so that was a fall.
No, that was a big fall. I'm of two minds about that. I mean, I do think it just depends on individual preference. Like, if you can still sit and listen to a comedian and laugh at them, God bless you, you should do it. But, you know, other people are not going to be able to for whatever reason, you know.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests and having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Let me ask you this. Like, now, you're about 57 years old, right?
That's exactly how old I am. Yeah.
And you're not at the Onion anymore. Do you find that there was a point after turning 50 that your ambitions kind of morphed in a weird way, that you weren't as interested in being as big or as known or as, you know, let's make the Onion the best? Or like, do you find in what way has your ambitions changed as you've gotten past 50? And 50 is specifically the number I'm curious about.
Yeah, thank you for that introspective question. So I am very self-identified as an incredibly driven and ambitious person, and I still am that. I don't think I've changed at all, even after 50. So my focus changes. You know, I work on a different thing. So after the age of 50, I wrote a couple of comedic books. I'm, you know, getting more into stand-up. I'm still going and performing at colleges. I'm teaching comedy, and so I'm really passionate about that. I love seeing students, you know, start from nowhere and go to get professional jobs writing comedy. That's incredibly satisfying. I think my body still has not, like, slowed down. So, because ultimately it does depend on your physical capacity for work. Because back in the early days of the Onion, when I was in my 20s and 30s, we would pull all nighters, we'd pull all weekenders, you know, trying to make the Onion perfect. And I'm still doing that crap. You know, I'm still pulling all nighters, you know, trying to do a little animated cartoon for my podcast or something like that. So I'm really comfortable in that space of not being famous, working really hard to make something funny that people will like, and not relying on a brand to get me there with a shortcut. So it's oftentimes why I leave the Onion so often, because it gets boring when you produce comedy under the umbrella of a major brand like that, because audiences don't really need to be as wooed when they trust the brand, you know?
I feel like stand-up would be a real, you know, interesting thing. Obviously, you know, it would be an interesting thing for you, but I feel like that would be a really great challenge to get great at it. Because for so many years, for decades, you were writing the funny and editing the funniest jokes and material out there. And then to learn the skill of, which again, I'm sure you have, but it takes like going up on stage every night, like to learn the skill of really performing those jokes, must be an amazing combination.
Yeah, I'm loving it. I do get out like almost every night. There are
enough that's great.
Open mics in Minneapolis where I live, and I just went to Chicago. I had like a weekend in Chicago, and I I got some time there. I got a little showcase.
Well, where'd you perform there?
It was at the Lincoln Lounge. Do you know that place?
No, but I've done the Laugh Factory in Chicago.
Yeah, when I first started, I had a mentor, Tim Clue. I don't know if you know Tim Clue.
Yeah.
He was getting me stage time at all the clubs in Chicago, like Zany's and everything else.
Oh, Zany's. I'm sorry. Zany's is where I performed in Chicago.
Yeah, great. It's a great place. And it's so fun to see like the individual cultures of each club. Some of them, you know, require a little banter, a little crowd work. Some of them don't want to interact with you. But yeah, I appreciate what you're saying. I do. That is kind of my new challenge, you know, is to try to master this area of comedy that I've neglected for so many years.
And, you know, one thing that's interesting is when you go to a school and they say, oh, here's, you know, Scott Dickers from The Onion, then everybody's choosing to go and see you. And so when you make a joke, they're more likely to laugh.
Yep.
But a stand-up situation, and particularly an open mic, which that's dangerous, but like,
yes,
you know, then they don't know you and the challenge is significantly harder. Like they're yep. almost like holding their hands crossed and saying, okay, you know, they're challenging you to make them laugh, as opposed to an audience that's very receptive. So now for myself, I enjoy public speaking where everybody knows me because I just know I'm going to make them laugh. Whereas like in a stand-up situation, and I owned a club in New York, but in a stand-up situation, it's hard. Like that's the yep. hardest thing ever.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot, that sort of demeanor that a stand-up comic needs to be instantly at least allowed by the audience to try to be funny for them. Because if you're a brand, if you're Bill Burr and you book an arena and you do that, you know you're going to do fine. You know, even if your jokes aren't great, you're getting a big boost by just being a guy that they know and love.
Yeah.
But so many comics who aren't household names, they have to cultivate this onstage demeanor that is kind of submissive and, you know, it's almost like you're on a first date, you know, with the audience.
And it won't work. If you are too submissive, the audience senses
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. You have to have find this perfect balance of ultra confidence and likability, a little bit of submissiveness that will allow them to laugh at you or with you and to kind of accept you and say, oh yeah, this guy is pretty funny. And it's a really tough balance to discover. And part of it is discovering your like persona. What's your onstage persona? What do people think of you when they see you? What's the vibe they get? And it's hard, you know, it takes a long time.
Yeah, no. And I think that's the under-recognized part of stand-up skill is that it is a persona. It's not necessarily a fake persona, but it is like an extreme version of something that's inside of yourself. Like for instance, you know, I have curly hair and glasses, right? So I look smart. And so my persona kind of evolved into someone who is saying things that sound smart, but are actually like really, really stupid. And because ultimately no one is smart and everything. So if I talk about parenting, I'm going to act like I'm being like a great parent, but I'm saying like the stupidest things about parenting. And then people, it's dissonant with how I look. So that became, you know, part of my act. But like, you know, you take someone like Andrew Schultz or even Dave Chappelle, with Andrew Schultz in particular, he's having a party on stage. So yes. Whenever even the times when he's not funny, you still want to laugh with him because you want to join the party. So that's his persona.
Yeah, he does this thing a lot of comics do that's really effective where they're stifling laughter almost the whole time, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes
Dave Chappelle's like that too.
Backing up. Yeah. It's a little trick that people use on stage to make the audience comfortable laughing. And it's harder to do if you're doing like a Stephen Wright bit or a Steve Martin type of performance where your whole persona is like the straight man, you know?
Yeah.
I guess Steve Martin did a lot of like smiling and stuff, but I guess Stephen Wright's a better example. or even like Andy Kaufman, where he's like being totally like scared and flat. It's fascinating. It's fun. It's fun to see what's been done. It's fun to see what the trends are and like how those can be bucked to come up with something new. Cause I think ultimately something new is what's going to really succeed in comedy. It's the new that always gets the attention.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I would say in general, because of the rise of TikTok and, you know, these other short form formats, there are a lot of funny things on YouTube and TikTok. Like in this, in terms of making me laugh, a lot funnier than stand-up. But stand-up as an art form, as a funny art form, is so great. And I appreciate it so much. It always wins for me over TikTok, even though TikTok's amazing in terms of, you know, humorous videos out there.
I know. And it can be daunting to know that when you're in the comedy business, you're out there competing against everyone in the world's best day.
Yeah.
somebody's having their best day because their video went viral that day. And that's your competition every single day.
And look, that's the competition for The Onion too. Like, I'm surprised The Onion and the Babylon Bee keep, you know, every month you're only as good as, it's really true. You're only as good as your last, you know, new edition. And every month they keep rising up and being topical and saying smart things and funny. And it's just always such a pleasure to read. I love comedy so much in all forms, but I've been reading The Onion for, gosh, again, I wish since the beginning, but I was only aware really when you were online. And then I was so surprised to see that you actually had a print editions. Now I know for the first time in decades, now I know the print edition came first. I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you discovered it when you did. That was a magical time, the mid to late 90s when we were first getting online. That was kind of when we were first getting known, you know.
Nationally, yeah.
Yeah.
And what would you think is the funniest, I'm sure you've been asked this, but what do you think is the funniest headline? And by the way, we always speak in terms of headlines because it's the headlines that are funny. The articles just sort of support the headline.
Yeah, no, they do. And we always start with the headline and the article is kind of an afterthought. But if it's well written and well done, which we always would try to do, of course, it builds on the headline and it gets funnier and funnier and funnier. But the funniest headline ever, my God, there's so many. But one of my all-time favorites is an editorial that The Onion did by the CEO of the Gillette Razor Company. And the headline was, "Fuck it, we're doing five blades." And at that time, Gillette, no one had done a five-bladed razor. And so it was hyperbole. And the article is so well written. It's so funny. The character of that guy is just hilarious. Highly recommend everyone Google that story, read it. It's super funny, fun read. But one of the reasons I like it so much is that just a few months later, after that article, Gillette unveiled a five-bladed razor. The Onion predicted the future by just a few months. And I love when The Onion predicts the future. There's nothing more satisfying than when you try to do something that you think is totally absurd hyperbole, and it works as humor, and then the world catches up with you, and the world becomes just as absurd as you could imagine.
Well, it could be because the world is absurd, right? So when you see stories, like mainstream stories about how, you know, congressmen own stocks related to the bills that they're, you know, stridently, you know, trying to pass, like that's absurd. Like that such a thing even exists and is barely, it's questioned, but it's barely questioned. So you could see how that's serious, but also with a little twist, it's absurd and funny. Or, you know, now I'm reading stories about this congresswoman was what's called swatted. Like people called up.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Marjorie Taylor Greene was swatted.
Marjorie Taylor Greene was swatted. Like people called up and said, I just killed, you know, five people. I'm at this address. And then she's just having dinner. And then the FBI and the police are there with guns. Like they don't know what they're facing. And like, that's absurd, but it's real.
Yeah. You know, That's the gift that the world gives to comedy, is that it's always absurd and people are always crazy and stupid, and you know, you're never going to run out of material. That this video went viral recently of the I think it was the House, some sort of House banking committee where the bankers that they were supposed to be regulating and one of the Congress people who was supposed to be regulating them were just winking at each other and laughing about how their staff works with them in Congress and then goes to work at the banks. And it's all this like glad handing and we're all buddies here. And it's just the creepiest video. Like there's nothing more absurd than that. And The Onion actually has been doing a good job recently of pointing out that absurdity about how our politics is completely corrupted and just owned by, you know, all the industries that we're supposed to be regulating and regular people are not, their interests are not being served by the government at all.
So if you think about it, the government is absurd and somewhat scam-like. Media is absurd and somewhat scam-like. What, you know, not counting The Onion, what industries are not absurd? Like even the medical industry, doctors, of course, recommend medicines that the pharma lobbyists, you know, sold to them. The legal industry is all a scam. Like, you know, lawyers are representing murderers that they know murdered and vice versa. Like what industry is not a scam?
Yeah, it goes back to what I was saying. The way I approach comedy is by looking at the audience as being divided into the 99% who are getting screwed and the 1% who are doing the screwing. And if you target that 99%, you're going to do great. And everything you mentioned is represented by the 1%. People in government, you know, multimillionaires, corrupt, just taking all this contribution money, bribe money from the corporations they're supposed to be regulating. The big businesses that profit off of people's suffering. Those are all the 1%. So it's easy to kind of look at society and say, oh, so much of it is corrupt. It's so simple for me to just say, no, it's just that 1%. They have all the power and all the money, basically.
It's true. You know, so like, let's say like 1% or 2% of the country does in fact own every industry. So every industry is a scam.
So like, is a scam.
Like you say, take Campbell's soup, for instance. Oh, it's soup with vegetables and blah, blah, blah. You know, if you actually send it to a chemist, it's filled with like the worst poisons possible to mankind. And without even like examining it, like that has to be true. No offense to Campbell's soup. Maybe I'm wrong. No.
It's actually surprising to me that any of it works at all, that the FDA can actually successfully regulate meat and canned food in such a way that we're all not just constantly poisoned and dying. Because the reason they set up the FDA originally was because big companies were canning poison and selling it to people and killing them.
Sure.
So the government stepped in. It was like, we gotta limit this somewhat. And so they come up with rules. But you know, everybody in the FDA is like with a big ag or a big pharma company. So I'm mystified that any of it works.
Yeah, I mean, the same thing happens with the FDA and the SEC, which regulates the stock market. It happens in Congress, is that you rise up in the SEC. Oh, of course, JP Morgan is going to hire you for $10 million a year because you know how to get around the SEC. So
right. It took that great move that FDR did by appointing
Joe Kennedy
as the first SEC director, right? Wasn't he the first?
Yeah, he was the first. FDR specifically hired him.
He hired him because he knew how to game the system. He knew how it worked. And that was just a genius move. Like, we'll hire the guy who knows exactly how to do it. It's like hiring Abagnale to nail scam artists at the FBI or something.
And the joke, by the way, is that none of the stories in Abagnale's book apparently were true.
It's all a scam. He's still scamming us.
I don't know if that's for sure, but someone just told me that the other day, that they couldn't verify any of the stories.
I wouldn't doubt it for a second. But we're riding on the coattails of that move by FDR to this day. We still think, like Trump used this a lot. He's like, oh, I know the crooks. I'll hire a crook to oversee the crooks, and that way they'll get rid of the crooks. We still buy that, even though now it's not working the same way anymore. We're just hiring foxes to guard the hen house is all we're doing now, you know.
Does it end well?
Oh my God. I'm an eternal optimist. but I'm also a doomer. So, you know, reconcile that somehow. It does seem like we're headed to hell in a handbasket. I just want to enjoy the ride, you know, do my best. And, you know, hopefully people will get a chuckle from my work along the way, you know.
I agree with you. Like, I've always been an optimist, but I guess for now, for the first time, I'm a little bit nervous just because there's so much weird tension all around the world. But hopefully there's still optimistic outcomes, like just things, like you said earlier, things just somehow it all fits. It's somehow it all works despite all the corruption and the scams. So I'm hoping that still happens, that, you know, Putin doesn't really want to drop nukes and Xi doesn't really want war all over the world and on and on and on. But we'll see. Humor does keep things alive. And look, I gave up like 5-6 years of career to, you know, cause I've had a bunch of different careers, but I sort of gave it all up to pursue comedy for 6 years, day and night, just because I loved it so much. And it really kept me going.
That's a noble quest, you know, to drop out and do comedy.
Yeah. And I still kept alive other things I was doing, but I was like at least 4 or 5 hours a day studying comedy or performing comedy, and like 5-6 nights a week going out and doing it. And it's brutal. If you ask my wife, my wife would either be like so happy because it went well, so I was happy, or just trying to explain to me, it's not as bad as you thought. Like, there were people laughing in the corner. It's just you didn't see them. So,
it's a tough world out there doing stand up. But yeah, as long as the world survives, you know, I'll keep doing it. I'll keep trying to be funny, and you know, the best case scenario is that we all go extinct while we're cracking up laughing.
Yeah, that's a great one. So Scott, what do you want people to buy? We're going to sell something for you. What do you feel like they should go out and buy?
Thank you for allowing me to be a part of your pitch fest. So yes, I sell books. You mentioned a couple of my books. The History of the Onion is called Outrageous Marketing, the story of the Onion and how to build a powerful brand with no marketing budget. A lot of funny stories about the Onion starting up there. My How to Write Funny book series, there's 4 books in that series.
I can't wait to get those.
Yeah, that'll teach you how to do comedy real fast. And then I have courses if you want to go deeper with me. How to Write Funny course and How to Succeed in the Comedy Business course. And if you want a bunch of free stuff, you can go to my website, howtowritefunny.com, where there's all sorts of resources for improving your comedy and getting better at doing comedy. And then, you know, you should subscribe to my podcast, Scott Dicker's Around. I try to be funny every week, and I do little animated cartoons. I do characters. That's where I do my stand-up ideas, you know, so that show becomes the grist for my stand-up material mill, you know.
I'm sorry I didn't know you had a podcast. I'm definitely going to start listening. Like, I find now that doing public speaking, like at a conference, is where I'm able to try stuff out because it's a little easier because everyone knows me. Everyone's going to laugh and I have a fun time with those.
But you know, you're not, and I do that too, but you're not getting, it's not a clean experiment because they already like you. So you got to do that at an open mic night or it doesn't count.
let me ask you this question. This will be the final question, but this is advice I gave my daughter. So one of my daughters was thinking of trying an open mic, and I gave her this advice, which is very taboo kind of advice. I said, you're going to an open mic. No one's really at an open mic. Some are good, but most of them are just open micers attending and they're worried about their own set. So no one's even listening to you when you're on stage. You're not going to get any laughs or very few, but here's what you should do, which is steal a joke from your favorite comedian or your favorite joke and try it out and see if people laugh. Because you know the joke's funny, so if they don't laugh, then it's your performance work needs work. And if they do laugh, then then you could start thinking about your own material, because then you could see, then you have a base point where you know a funny joke, your performance skill is good enough, they'll laugh at a funny joke. Now you could write your own material and see if it works. Now that's taboo to steal a joke, but for an open mic and for just educational purposes, it's like it's like a band doing a cover. Like if someone does a cover of, the best Beatles song in the world. If it doesn't work for an audience, it means you suck as musicians. And that's how you know.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting bit of advice because, and I don't disagree with it, because almost anybody starting out in comedy started by copying other people. Any comedian you research, any comedy writer you research, you know, they started doing other people's material.
Oh yeah, Rosie O'Donnell was doing Jerry Seinfeld right after Jerry Seinfeld would do it.
Steve Martin was stealing, you know, bits that he heard other people do. George Carlin was doing Bill Cosby's records in school. I aped Mad Magazine and tried to write funny articles like Mad Magazine. We all do it. So as long as she knows, like, this is how you start. As soon as you try that, you never do it again.
Right. Like, don't do it in your Netflix special.
Totally.
But just at an open mic, just as a test to see where your weak points are. And she was like trying to tell me, no, you can't steal a joke. But I'm just saying, you're just learning. And it's not like everybody's putting this on YouTube and then you're going to get banned from the industry. Like, this is a good way to learn. So
another way you could do it is, you could, if she's nervous about stealing material, she could just go on stage at an open mic with no material. Just go up there without any pre-planned material and just talk to the audience as if she has encountered someone on the street and just see how it feels, you know, because that's ultimately what it's going to be. And you're going to bomb, you're going to fail anyway. Like you said, it's mostly other comedians at the open mic. Don't stress yourself out, you know?
Yeah, you know, and along those lines, there's a couple of good specials that are just crowd work. So like Andrew Schultz, for instance, who we talked about earlier, he's done a crowd work special. Judah Friedlander has done a crowd work special. Todd Barry, he's done a great crowd work special. It was unbelievable. You know, those crowd work specials are also good to see how they pull it off. It's very, very interesting.
Yep. Crowd work is like the hidden secret of comedy. People love it. It's like doing improv and the stakes are lowered. Like, you don't have to have as good material. And if you do it enough, you find this people are saying the same thing. So you can actually develop an act. Crowd work. And I've seen, I opened for Judah once and he did his whole act was crowd work with the audience. And it's kind of a lot of the same material you see in his special. You know, he has a system for it.
Yeah, well, he's got. I don't know if this was the same shtick, but he had his whole thing. I'm running for president. Ask me any issue. Now, of course, everyone's going to ask similar issues. Yeah,
they all do. Yeah, he's got answers. Yeah. So crowd work is a great way to do it, and it's a nice way to open up an open mic too, because most people are, there's like two people, they're sitting way in the back, you know. You're going to get more out of it if you try some crowd work, definitely.
Well, Scott, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, and I'm a really big admirer of everything you've accomplished, and it's really such a great thing. I so much love doing this podcast because I get to talk to people like you, and I appreciate you coming on the podcast. Thank you so much.
It is my pleasure. Thank you so much for the kind words. It's my delight to be here and a super fun conversation. So thank you for having me, James.
Thanks.
Really appreciate it.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.